is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Not-for-profit development has gotten progressively more sophisticated over the last 40 years. One staple element in the development portfolio is special events, whether it's something like the Free Store Food Bank's Rubber Duck Regatta, or something more modest like the Five Points Alley Beer Garden in Walnut Hills. Whether designed as fundraisers, friendraisers, or activities that are ends in themselves, these events always promote the organization's brand and an understanding of the mission and programs of the organization. To explore the ways that organizations and communities are using special events, we are joined today by the director of the Master of Public Administration Program and associate professor at Northern Kentucky University, Dr. Julie Olberding. To join our discussion, you can call 513-419-7100, or you can email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Julie, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you.
So you use the term, and very honestly, I'm not even sure how to pronounce it, purposive gatherings. What do you mean by that?
So there's many definitions of events in the literature, and really to boil it down to its basic notion, it's this idea of activities that bring people together for a purpose. And there may be additional descriptors to that, such as an unusual, not day-to-day experience. There may be symbols and rituals involved, but it just boils it down to its basic definition that an event is a purposive gathering of people.
And you say in your book that you're particularly interested in viewing this through the lens of social enterprise. Mm-hmm. Now, once again, that's in the literature on lots of things.
Yes.
Especially in the not-for-profit world.
Yes.
So what do you mean by social enterprise?
Again, boiling it down to a basic level, this is a relatively new term in terms of the literature, probably late 70s, early 80s. So it's this idea of some type of venture that has a social purpose or mission. Some of the traditional ones that we can think of are something like the Goodwill stores, where their mission or purpose is to help prepare people for the workplace. So they open up a store, sell secondhand goods, and that money goes back to their social purpose or mission. To me, we've had events around for a long time that have had a social purpose or mission. Like you talked about, the Rubber Duck Regatta to raise money for the Free Store Food Bank. And then some other ones like Play in the Park that were designed to take back and make space safe again in a community. So using that, I felt that lens was appropriate, social enterprise, to look at special events because they have this social purpose or mission. And if they're not applying business principles and methods, it's probably a good idea that they do to make them as successful as possible and as sustainable as possible.
Well, you just mentioned two special events that are very different in size.
Yes.
And scope. So when you're looking at something like, let's start with the Rubber Duck Regatta.
Mm-hmm.
When you're looking at something like the Rubber Duck Regatta, what's the criteria that you would use to evaluate how effective it is, whether it's meeting its needs and its purpose? So how would you look at a big event like that?
That's a great question. I think I would say that it gets back to why was the event created? And I mean, I can look at that as a third-party observer, but it's also the board that's involved, the staff members that are involved, you know, to continuously revisit what the mission or purpose of the event is. So with the Rubber Duck Regatta, I've read articles about it and been on their website, and it's twofold. I mean, one piece of it is to raise money for the Free Store Food Bank, and they've been incredibly successful at doing that.
About $10 million.
Yeah, over 20 years.
Yeah. Right.
So incredibly successful with that portion of the mission. And then kind of the secondary, but probably equally as important, is to raise awareness about people who are homeless or hungry in our region and the fact that the Free Store Food Bank is helping to serve that need.
So that's at one end, and we could use a lot of events like that. I would suggest that another one we could look at would be Blink. That was just last year, last fall, which was huge in scale, brand new, not going to be repeated this year, but probably in the future. probably looking at similar criteria as the Rubber Duck Regatta mm-hmm. in the sense of, does it make money?
Mm-hmm.
And does it meet other needs? And in their case, I think it's exposing the arts to a lot more people in,
exactly.
in downtown. But let's take a look at the other one that you mentioned, which was Play in the Park. Most people listening to us probably don't even know what that is. So first off, describe what it is and then talk about how you would evaluate something like that.
Sure. So I had hoped that Susan Wade Murphy could have joined us today. She couldn't. She's a very busy schedule. So I hope that I'll be able to represent Play in the Park as best as I can. But probably to step back a little bit, it takes place in a park called Kennedy Heights Park, which is between Kennedy Heights and Pleasant Ridge, two neighborhoods of the 52 in Cincinnati. And it's located, for your listeners who don't know, probably in the furthest northeastern part of the city. So between Norwood and Kenwood, Oakley and Amberley. And in 2013, there were two incidents in the summer involving shootings, and two people were murdered.
In the park?
Near the park.
Near the park.
Near the park.
Okay.
And so community members gathered both to remember the people who were murdered, but also to kind of voice their unity and solidarity about bringing the park back to become something safe. So it was a vigil, which is actually an event, a community event. And Susan Wade Murphy, who was there, and others heard children and families talking about how they didn't feel like they could go back to the park, that they weren't safe. And Susan and others felt that this was unacceptable. I mean, it's a community park, beautiful park, 12 acres. It has a soccer field, playground, picnic tables, and had been used quite a bit. But it is on a hill surrounded by trees. So everyone understood why their people didn't feel safe. And so Susan decided to create a once-a-week event every Wednesday in the summer to take back that space, to make it vibrant and positive. So every week there are activities. The Kennedy Heights Art Center provides arts and crafts. There's live music. And the committee that works on it is intentional about having different types of music, so bluegrass, hip-hop, Americana, rock and roll. So that just the volume. Yeah.
People from different parts of the community.
Right. And people can hear, you know, it's an enclosed park, but people can hear that there's music happening and they go there. And really back to that idea, and I'm not sure if I mentioned this enough about social enterprise, but in the area of social enterprise, it's where you see nonprofit organizations engaging with the private sector, often in partnership with government or the public sector. So with Play in the Park, it was the Kennedy Heights Community Council, Pleasant Ridge Community Council, which are nonprofits. Play in the Park's a nonprofit. And then they work in partnership with the Cincinnati Police, Cincinnati Parks. They've gotten donations from the private sector. I know Cavalier Distributing made a big contribution this year. So it really is this multi-sectoral collaborative effort. And I guess back to your question about whether it's successful or not and how to measure it,
mm-hmm.
the main purpose of Play in the Park was to make that area safe again and also build community. And so within the first year of it happening, serious crimes like murder, rape, robbery decreased by 70% in the surrounding area. And it's been recognized with an Innovations Award from the City of Cincinnati, and other communities are looking to adopt a similar model.
I think one of the things that you can say about that particular event is that Kennedy Heights itself has been, you use this term, an intentional, the event was intentional, but Kennedy Heights has been an intentional neighborhood. People have lived in that neighborhood and said, we are going to stay here. We're going to have a neighborhood that is integrated on many levels, not just race, but also economics and all sorts of other things, and have stuck to it for a long period of time. So they had skills going into that.
Absolutely.
To do that. The other thing that strikes me about that, that could have been an event after these terrible events. The murders took place and have disappeared, would mm-hmm. have could have disappeared you know, in 6 months once it got cold and never come back the next summer. But it's come back, right?
Yes. Yes. It's commitment by not only Susan, but Jane Dressing, who is a resident of Kennedy Heights and her family. My husband has been involved actually with helping to do the music part of it. And now they're actually looking to make it even more permanent by building a stage there. So every Wednesday, a stage is brought in and set up.
Is that the recreation department stage?
No, it's my husband's stage.
Oh, it's your husband's stage. Oh, okay.
He just brings it in pieces and builds it. And so the idea is to make it even more permanent. So we're going to try to work on a fundraising campaign, a small fundraising campaign, and work with the parks to develop a stage that has the capability to have sound. So it may even be beyond these Wednesday evenings to make it easier for other days and evenings to
Well,
do it.
One of the aspects here that you just brought up is fundraising. And events have, for a long time, been part of fundraising programs, efforts, one of the tools in the toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to come back to that and talk about how events get used in that fundraising environment, because I think there are some interesting things going on there. So, you know, one of the things that we were talking about, Julie, and I sort of hinted at in this introduction, was the role of how branding takes place. And really strong events that have legs over a period of time, you know, it's just like in business. You've got to have a brand, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is one of the, I think, takeaways from the book and looking at different types of events and borrowing from the business literature that, you know, there is the purpose of a brand is to distinguish an event in this case. You know, what's unique about it? What's authentic about it? And then to make sure that it's separate from other types of events. And one key way to do that is an image, but there's also the words that go along with the brand and just being consistent in that.
I think particularly, you know, this is bouncing back up to a large event,
mm-hmm.
but the Flying Pig Marathon. And Ira Simpson Bush is just, as far as I'm concerned, a genius at and a skilled marketer, but also has got just built that into an incredible event. And so if you're looking at that, that's not just a local event. People come from all over the United States. How would you evaluate something like that?
Well, it's true. And I think there is actually a chapter that focuses specifically on the branding of the Flying Pig Marathon. And it could have been called anything when they were initiating it. And they talked about the Seven Hills Marathon and sort of more bland names for it. But the idea—
Not to mention that there aren't seven hills. Okay. So that's another show, but let's just kill that again. Okay, go ahead.
So this idea of a flying pig, because it's Porkopolis and part of the imagery that we have, and that it was just a really fun brand that they could work with in terms of images and ideas behind it. But I think, you know, I would have to go back and visit the Flying Pig Marathon's mission to talk about it specifically, but I think it is to provide a unique, authentic experience for all levels of runners. I mean, they went into it knowing that they weren't going to be a New York City marathon or a marathon for hyper-competitive. They didn't offer big prizes for winners and age group winners. The whole thing was providing a great, interesting experience for all runners and walkers. So they invested money in the goodie bags, and they have bands along the course, and they have these parties all weekend connected to the event. So I think that, you know, in looking at success, there's multiple ways to look at it, but we've seen that the numbers of participants have grown. They do surveys every year of participants in terms of their satisfaction. I actually worked with them 1 year to do a survey of volunteers, because these are all leading indicators. I mean, you have your ultimate lagging indicators, how many people showed up, how much money did you make, mm-hmm. but then kind of wanting to get a earlier sense of how things are going to catch red flags or great things that are happening to build on. And so asking participants, what did they love, what didn't they like, same with volunteers. But I think their results have been consistently high in terms of people being very satisfied with the event and the experience.
Yeah, and you know, in terms of creating an image for the city that is fun and puts us in that whole running world, plus their commitment to raising money and then not using it themselves, but distributing it to not-for-profits that they care about.
Absolutely.
Around the city.
Yeah, and just a couple of things before we get away from that. I think one thing that's important is that their brand has been tied to the city of Cincinnati. So we talk about this issue of co-branding with this event. It's a really positive, valuable event that could have just been the Flying Pig Marathon, but really making this connection so the value and equity that's built in the event is shared with the city. So it just helps the city in that sense. But also to your point, my husband and I, Doug, is a professor at Xavier University and he studies sports studies. So an area where our research converges is events and their impact. So we developed a conceptual model of not economic impacts, which is what most people look at, but non-economic or social impacts. And the one that you just talked about is really important, raising money for social causes. And I'm not sure of the exact number, but it's been something like $15 million that the Flying Pig Marathon has raised for nonprofit organizations, schools, and other charities in our region.
So it's a big event, has a lot of impact on a lot of different levels. You know, events are something that lots of not-for-profits use, and whether they're dinners, are there certain types of events that either are wearing out, or is it that a certain type of event wears out for any organization if they use it too long, and it may be just fine for another organization, but do you see trends where there's certain types of events that simply are losing their impact?
I think that's a really great question. And it probably depends on the organization and the organization members doing the research on what currently exists in their community and when it happens. So this is part of the market research, if you will, kind of in air quotes, because we know that community members and nonprofits can't do really deep dives into market research, but really just looking around and assessing, looking at calendars for events and, you know, what they're going to be competing with. I will say I teach classes and we work with community partners on service learning projects. So this past spring, we worked with the Mount Airy and Mount Washington Community Development Councils. And Daniel Trakoff, who's the staff person for both, basically said, I don't want any runs or walks. You know, I just feel like the market is saturated. And maybe in those two neighborhoods and nearby neighborhoods, I do think we're a big running city. I think there's a lot of runs and walks that are out there. So it's challenging to create a new one and find a weekend where there aren't five or six other runs or walks happening.
Literally.
And, you know, to find your market and be unique and authentic and attract people to your event versus another one.
I also wonder if, you know, the awards dinner, you know, part of that depends on corporations being willing to buy tables. And then they are supposed to find employees who are going to sit at those. I think some of that really gets kind of tired after a while.
Yeah, and it may be generational. I think that you know, and those raise a lot of money. You know, they can raise a lot of money. And if you're talking $1,000 per table or $5,000 a table, nonprofits have been very successful, and that's their number one fundraiser. So more power to them. If it's working and continues to work, that's great. But I think for younger generations, that formal gala type event isn't as appealing. So what we're seeing now is, you know, this category of events that are related to creative placemaking. So how do we, oftentimes in initially unappealing sites, you know, alleyways and...
Well, I think you talk about the Walnut Hills Five Points Alley.
Yeah. That's an example where definitely on the other extreme of a gala. So in this alley where people have done drugs and drank and there's, you know, needles and old liquor bottles and cans. And so people in the community basically said, you know, we don't like this, how it is. We're going to start cleaning it up. I wasn't involved in this, so this, I'm, you know, reiterating the story, but mm-hmm. groups of people went in on Saturdays with pickle buckets and picked up garbage and moved it out and then decided, why don't we start enjoying ourselves on Sundays in the same space, turning it into something positive. So turned over their pickle buckets, sat on them, brought beer, did live music, and then eventually, kind of similar to the play in the park, built a more permanent stage, set up some lights and electricity so that this is an event that's way less formal, but to the mission and the purpose that they wanted to create that into something positive.
So there's a lot of parallels with Kennedy Heights, Pleasant Ridge, Play in the Park. And it has legs. It's been going on for a while.
Yes. And it has helped attract. So, you know, it was this idea that, you know, the whole thing, if you build it, they will come. In this case, is people were there. And so developers decided to build things and restaurants started to go there. So Gomez Salsa and other businesses recognized that there are people there that are excited about getting together and drinking and eating and building community. And so they decided to invest in those areas. And then residential development comes along with that. And Walnut Hills, and this is really Kevin Wright of the Walnut Hills Redevelopment Foundation.
Who has left, by the way.
Yes. But really critical in those 8 years or so that mm-hmm. he was there to use creative placemaking as one of the tools.
So placemaking is sort of a sub-theme here of what you can do with special events.
Yes.
And so I think we have a caller who's called in, and I want to get to him before we run to her before we run out of time. Stephanie, you just called with a observation or a question. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I live in Clifton, and I'm relatively new to Cincinnati, about 4 years. And I just wanted to point out the great work that Maslow's Army is doing. You know, you brought up the galas and the $1,000 plate functions, and excuse me, for people like me, that's out of the question. And I think the newer generation is going more towards the grassroots where, you know, you actually go out and you meet with people on the street, you work in a soup kitchen. I myself personally have gone down to McMicken Park, Washington Park, those kinds of places with clothing, linens, toiletries, and that's through my efforts of just reaching out to my friends on Facebook to say, hey, if you've got something that you don't want anymore, I'll come and pick it up, and I'll take it down to the folks that are literally on the streets. And Maslow's Army is doing a wonderful, wonderful job. Sam and Susan Landis are, you know, trying their best to do exactly that, to be on the street with food, with clothes, and reaching out to the folks that are on the street rather than through an organization.
I want to get Julie's response to this, but thank you for calling. And, of course, this is directly related to an issue that's sort of on the forefront of the community's mind at this moment, and that's homelessness, people especially homeless who are on the street. Julie, what's your reaction to that kind of really going to where the need is?
Yeah. Well, I think Stephanie's point, I mean, I think it echoes how a lot of people are feeling these days. I think there's two overarching trends in our society. One is that we've become very much on screen and digital, disconnected from our communities. And so I think that community events are a way to bring people together, build social capital, help others, serve others directly. And then I think the other trend, which, I mean, there was an article in the column in the New York Times last month about this idea of a localist revolution. So there's so much chaos happening at the national level in terms of politics and government and service that David Brooks brought up this idea of people wanting to have an impact and to see an impact and to relate with people. So I think that community events may be part of this trend too in terms of getting back to our grassroots and building relationships on the ground and helping people on the ground.
Well, I think there is historically change occurs locally first, almost always. And it doesn't come from the top. It bubbles up from the bottom. And what you're saying is that sort of We're seeing that again, and what Stephanie's calling in about is rooted. The interesting thing also about Stephanie's call is there was a social networking component to her call in the sense that her friends are on Facebook, she hears about the things, and she's drawn in to action from that. So that's really interesting too. I really want to thank Julie Olberding for being with us today.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.